Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Order is sustained. Once again, two guests today. We'll hear from Edwin Ackerman on the Mexican election, which saw a landslide victory for Claudia Sheinbaum, who will succeed the immensely popular AMLO, and then from Joel Whitney about the security state's harassment of some prominent radicals of the Western Hemisphere. On June 2nd, Mexico held elections for the presidency in both houses of the legislature. The results were a landslide victory for the party of the current president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known universally as AMLO. The victor, Claudia Sheinbaum, got just shy of 60% of the vote, and her and AMLO's party, Morena, the National Regeneration Movement, got huge majorities in the Senate and Chamber of Deputies. The reason for this landslide was AMLO's stunning popularity, the result of some serious successes while in office, notably a major reduction in poverty and increase in the welfare of the working class. Here with more is Edwin Ackerman, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Syracuse University. His article in Sidecar, the blog of New Left Review, though a year old, is still very much worth reading, and he should be out with a follow-up soon. Edwin Ackerman. I was just looking at the economic stats the other day, and on paper they look quite orthodox. Pretty high interest rates, budget surplus. And I guess this is all part of that whole program of Republican austerity. But evidently it worked pretty well, and people are pleased. So how do we reconcile something that on paper looks pretty conservative with results that look quite populist?
There's, on the one hand, at the macroeconomic level, a certain orthodoxy. I would add that if you compare that to, let's say, Lula, at least, you know, in the first two terms, you could see a similarity there where there's a certain orthodoxy at the macroeconomic level. And then the interesting stuff, as it were, is happening at different levels of the economy. And I think what's happening in Mexico is that there is the significant push. And now we can also show actual outcomes in that sense. In favor of the working classes. There's a significant decrease in poverty, and more importantly, that decrease in poverty concentrates in the working poor. Now, the policies are a mix, on the one hand, of cash transfer programs, but also a significant push in favor of workers' rights, including things like historic increase to the minimum wage, elimination of precarious hiring practices known as outsourcing, facilitation of the formation of new unions, and a series of other things along that route that have had that effect on the economy. In addition to that, I would say that there is this big push for the state to be a developmentalist agency. And this has taken the form primarily of embarking in what the government calls mega projects, or what people in the country know as mega projects. These are big infrastructure projects that involve things like airports, trains, refineries, etc. And all of this done under the pre-neoliberal logic of public works. There's a huge kind of pumping into the economy in a way that goes directly to people at the bottom. How to reconcile that with the macroeconomics? I mean, I think there's two things going on there. On the one hand, there is a certain overcorrection, if you will, by AMLO and other figures of the pink tide, that they come, you know, to power after decades of neoliberalism, where one of the big selling points of neoliberalism, if it was true or not, is a separate matter. It wasn't, but a selling point was its orthodoxy, its fiscal orthodoxy. Right, that it was a much more stable system, you know, that was moving away from inflationary pressures and so on. And I think some of his leaders, and AMLO included, come to power already trying to foreshadow that this will be a line of critique, and they are, again, overcorrecting in that sense. But the other thing to add is that he has a very specific understanding of neoliberalism, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about it later, which moves away from the idea that neoliberalism was the contraction of the state in the service of the free market. It's a view that really emphasizes a retooling or reinstrumentalization of the state in the service of, not even of the market in some abstract sense, but in the service of private interest specifically. And so the idea has always been that, to put it in his own terms, that the money is there, but it was all siphoned off through corruption, so that if you eliminate that, you can use all that money to embark in this effort.
Now, the view of neoliberalism, it's true that this idea that was just the clawing back of the state is incorrect, because it was the use of state power to pursue very specific goals. But AMLO is also trying to, or has been trying to, undo that ideology about the state and to rebuild state capacity that was hollowed out and just change people's attitudes about politics. How successful was he on that agenda?
You know, I think at this point, for example, it is taboo for any mainstream party to call itself neoliberal, or to, at least at the discursive level, campaign with those flags. That in itself, just at the level of discourse, or you could say at the level of political culture, is a significant success. This is sort of, you know, equivalent to when Margaret Thatcher said that her biggest success was the New Labour Party, right? It's the idea that the basic parameters of debate, at least discursively, are shifted as an effect of that. That said, I mean, the discredit of the state is very deep, right? Because it's decades and decades of misuse of it. But you do see some changes there in the general population's understanding of the state. The Gallup, for example, put out this interesting poll recently that first showed AMLO having an incredible amount of support. I think 80% is what Gallup had him on. But the other interesting points from there were how people were feeling about democracy, about the prospects of government working for the general population. And you'd see there significant increases over the past 6 years. There is a process ongoing of re-legitimation of the state.
Liberals of the professional managerial class didn't like AMLO's attitudes on what we call the social issues, like abortion and LGBTQ rights. On that, I have to say I'm with them. What about that, and where does this leave his coalition as he departs?
Right. Yeah. One of the interesting points to me was the changing in the class composition of his support base, right? So he started off in the election in 2018 when he first got elected, with a support base of the middle classes. And then in his time in office, that shifted towards the working classes, right? He has vast support because he's a popular president. So it's not like you're going to have these big pockets of opposition in the middle classes. You will, for sure, in the upper classes, in the business class, right? But it is true that if you look at the level of support, the vast majority of his support comes from below, and the vast majority of its opposition comes from the business class and the professional classes. One thing that's interesting about the election that just happened with Claudia Sheinbaum's victory is the victory is so overwhelming, right, just in terms of its numbers, that it includes back into a coalition several sectors of the middle classes. If you look at the numbers in terms of who supported her candidacy more than other sectors, you still find that the overwhelming support comes from below. But different fractions of the middle classes also ended up voting for her over her opponents. So what you have emerging, at least potentially in this immediate juncture, is this coalition of working classes and middle classes with the valence of it still grounded in the working classes. Because this coalition, the securing of this coalition, did not involve moving to the right, right? The campaign was not a campaign about moving to the right to appeal to the middle classes. It was about the continuation of AMLO's policies. Now, why is that happening? I mean, in short, I think Claudia Sheinbaum, at least in this moment, seems friendlier to the language, the concerns, the framings that some of these credential classes prioritize.
Well, she is one, right? She's a,
exactly, yes,
a scientist. She comes from a family of scientists, but she's also shares the class politics of AMLO. So how is she going to balance these competing loyalties?
Right. That's a great question. So on the one hand, yes, in terms of her personal background, you know, she's an academic, as you know, as the foreign press loves to emphasize, a climate scientist, comes from a family of scientists and so forth. At the same time, she was formed politically in the movement around López Obrador. She begins her journey to politics as a student, as part of a student movement in UNAM against efforts to privatize it in the 80s. And then her first big position is as Minister of the Environment in AMLO's term as mayor of Mexico City in 2000. That's her first real entrance into the spotlight. For the past at least 25 years or so, she's been part of the movement, part of the foundation of the party Morena, there in all of the big electoral battles in 2006, 2012, that were the post-electoral period was very embattled in those two elections. She was a central piece of all of that. So her training is really in Obradorismo as a movement, her political training. But yes, that said, I think there are moments in which discursively and in practice, there has to be an effort at synthesizing some of the currents that are sort of identified or crystallized in AMLO and the currents that crystallize in somebody like Claudia Sheinbaum. One example of this that I've seen so far in interviews is, for example, the idea of the prioritizing of the energy transition versus the energy sovereignty, even if it means investing in fossil fuels that AMLO is a proponent of. In AMLO's tenure, the idea was, let's rescue Pemex, the state-owned oil company. Let's invest in it. Let's make it an engine of growth. And all of this happening, obviously, in the midst of a climate crisis, right? So the idea of investing in fossil fuels for certain sectors of progressives seemed wrongheaded. That, in his mind, in AMLO's mind, was balanced or had to be weighed against the idea of energy sovereignty and of state developmentalism. And now, in Sheinbaum, who is, again, a climate scientist, part of this big team that won a Nobel Prize, the question of energy transition is much more clearly on the agenda. And the way that she's synthesized or solved that potential tension between AMLO's way of thinking about it and hers is to say that Pemex is the key that will help the country pay for the transition, right? So the idea is, yes, still invest in fossil fuels, still milk Pemex, and think about how those funds can be used in the service of a state-led transition. Just to make a final point about that synthesis, here it's important to keep in mind that the way that the struggle around environmentalism and around the green transition has happened in Mexico, the struggle at the political level takes on these very interesting dimensions. The proponents of the transition of green energy is really green capital. And then the proponents, in a sense, of fossil fuels is state-owned enterprises. So, for example, after a series of reforms to the energy sector that AMLO undertook, a series of companies, of private companies, appealed to the rules of NAFTA and are still in the process of doing so legally, claiming that these reforms to the energy sector that gave state preponderance to in the electricity generation, that constituted a violation of NAFTA. But interestingly, what they argue is not just that it's a violation in terms of profit, but that it's a violation in environmental terms because they produce greener energy, right? So green capital versus state sovereignty. That's the dividing lines that have emerged. So Sheinbaum has to synthesize those two and say state-led green transition in which, again, Pemex is going to help fund.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Edwin Ackerman. If your government revenue and indeed a good bit of your economic strategy depends upon the oil sector, at the same time you're looking to dismantle it over the long term, it's not easy to square that circle.
The first thing is that the dependence on oil in particular, economically speaking, I think is not as central as it was in the past, and certainly, you know, not as central as, I don't know, let's say Venezuela or something like that. It's a significant industry with a lot of historical legacy. for a sector of the left, at least in the country, the expropriation of the oil industry in the 1930s by Cárdenas has been the sort of foundational moment, at least of, again, of a certain sector of the country's left. So it's a very important sector economically and also culturally, historically, and so forth. But I think the economy is diversified. The ways I think that they're thinking of using Pemex is not just in terms of exports, but also in terms of different ways of subsidizing local consumption. But yeah, I mean, yes, it's challenging for sure.
There's a piece by Jorge Castañeda the other day in which he was ventilating about the threat to democracy, undoing checks and balances. He sounded like he is James Madison reincarnated. What are these guys upset about?
A big chunk of the liberal press, and this includes a big fraction of academics, I would say sort of political scientists, and, are concerned with what they call democratic backsliding. What they mean by this in practice can be a little ambiguous. It'll involve things like the claim that AMLO is trying to dismantle the Electoral Institute or to take over the courts, but also claims that he interfered in the election. If you look at the actual details of these accusations, you get, I think, a different sense of what's going on. There's the idea, for example, of electoral intervention. What they mean by that is that AMLO has daily morning conferences, right? He's been holding these conferences throughout the six-year period. And in these conferences, he will talk about some of the good things that he thinks his government is doing, right? Or some of the critiques he might have of the opposition. These conferences are open to journalists in general. There's no mandate from the state for television to play them or anything like that. In fact, most people don't even see them on television. They just look for them online. But they have a certain success in managing the media agenda, right? In influencing the media agenda.
That sounds just like being a good politician.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in terms of something like the Electoral Institute or the courts, there I think there's more substance to the debate. Let's take the court. The AMLO administration, particularly in the second half, has been really embattled with the courts, particularly the Supreme Court. Right, the Supreme Court has toppled a series of major reforms that had passed through the legislature, only to be blocked there at the end. And in fact, part of what was on the agenda in the campaign was something that he refers to as Plan C. The origin of that is that there was this series of legal setbacks to these major reforms that had passed through legislature, right? So Plan A was to get X reform passed through legislature. It gets passed, but then it gets reversed in the courts. There's a modification to that reform, passes through the legislature, only to be stopped again by the courts. And that's when famously in one of these morning conferences, he says they have to move now to Plan C. And Plan C means winning 2/3 majority in the presidential elections. So part of what was discussed during the campaigns was the idea of needing a 2/3 majority to undertake this Plan C. So the Plan C is a series of reforms. It's 18 reforms. The most controversial ones are the election of judges at different levels. Now, in the U.S., we know there's a bunch of judges that are elected. I think half of the states elect judges at some level by direct election. In some states in the U.S., they even present themselves with partisan labels, right? But this is a very foreign idea in Mexico. So that would be one of the examples that this sort of crowd that is worried about so-called democratic backsliding would be thinking about. The problem there is that the only reason why they're worried about it is that AMLO is popular. They are worried that if they go to elections in this particular juncture of any sort, in practice, it means that people are going to elect people aligned in one way or another with AMLO. But they mask what is really a conjunctural problem for them, which is that in the present, the executive is really popular with a discussion of, democratic principles and so forth. None of those would be an issue if somebody else was in power or if AMLO was unpopular. You know, the examples about this double standards, I think, are vast in the country. You know, Cedillo in the PRI ex-president in the late 90s dissolved the Supreme Court at some point, etc. You can go down the line of moments in which you could talk about democratic sliding in which this very same sector of intellectuals thought it was the right thing to do in order to advance the neoliberal reforms.
There is a succession problem. You look at Maduro and Dilma, they were nothing like their predecessors, Chavez and Lula. Will Sheinbaum face the same challenges?
That's the big question, right? Part of the issue with some of the cases that you mentioned is, going back to a previous point, is the degree to which the projects initially were pegged to the commodity boom. That was the case definitely in Venezuela and Brazil. And when that commodity boom dried up, the successor was left with little margin to continue with the project and, in a sense, had to backtrack. In the Mexican case, the economy sort of diversified in that way. And I would add that the positive effects that we've seen in the past years in terms of reductions of poverty and so on happened even in the aftermath of the pandemic. You know, it's easy to forget that, you know, for 2 years of the 6 year period, the whole world was in a slump. There is something maybe much more lasting about the AMLO project that doesn't depend on something specific like the commodity boom. The issue, to put it in a more concrete way, is whether a tax reform is going to be necessary. I think that's the real, real practical question. AMLO's position on this was, we don't need to increase taxes on the rich on the books. We just need to get them to pay what they're already supposed to be paying. Increase effective tax collection. And he's done it. You can see the numbers now. The question now is that truly enough? And that's a tough question, you know, because on the one hand, so I was saying that the delegitimation of the state, even if in the past 6 years it has been somewhat ameliorated, is very deep. And so the distrust of a government proposing to increase taxes, even if it specifies that it's on the upper classes, etc., the distrust, I think, is a general distrust of the state. The idea being like, you know, why are we going to pay more if they're going to steal it or misuse it? I don't know if the political balance, the political juncture is going to be propitious for that in the next coming years, if it's needed, right? If it has to be put on the table.
Any lessons from AMLO for the outside world?
I've been thinking about a lot about that because on the one hand, it is clear that this is a success, right? Just at the level of the actual transformation of general of people's lives and politically speaking, the victory a couple of weeks ago is overwhelming. This is a mandate in the clearest way, in a context, I would say, also in which clear mandates in the Western world, at least, are a thing of the past, right? I think we're very used to very close elections. The second thing that is, I think, unique of what's emerging here is this coalition, again, might be a temporary one, but this coalition between middle classes and working classes, with, again, the balance of power of the agenda being on the side of the working classes. So you're folding in middle classes to a project that is essentially for the working classes. Or, I mean, as it's synthesized really in the slogan of the movement, for the benefit of all, the poor go first. All this to say that there's some elements here that might be, I guess, unique to the Mexican case. I don't know to what extent can be just sort of replicated in other parts. But that said, I would say two things here. One is that the question of corruption is a question that moves people very significantly, mobilizes people very significantly. And it's a mistake to think that anti-corruption politics are politics led by the right in an anti-statist way, because that's been the case in many of the other anti-corruption movements across the Western world. We have a case here of anti-corruption politics being mobilized by the populist left. successfully. That would be my first point. A second point that is perhaps more controversial is that AMLO has emphasized explicitly several times that the question of safety and the question of family, and here, you know, he specifies different types of families, but the idea of family should not be terrain that should be left to the right, that the left has to talk about it, has to have a position on it. Again, because it is something that that moves people, and if you don't take it up, the right wing will take it up. So the third thing is that there's this sort of weird paradox with the left reaching power in the context of decades of neoliberalism, where the efforts historically of the left in those contexts become ironically to almost recreate true neoliberalism by creating a separation between economic power and political power. This sort of ideal of neoliberalism as the economic sphere separated from the political sphere, for paradoxical reasons, the left comes to power and comes to power often with the aim of doing that, of saying we need to separate. And AMLO himself sometimes uses that language, separate political power from economic power. And I think that's not the right framing for this. I think that the aim is not the separation of political from economic power, but the subordination of economic power to political power.
That was Edwin Ackerman, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Syracuse University. My name is Doug Henward. The program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Pessoa by Marcos Balter, performed by Claire Chase. Next, Radicals on the Run, pursued by the CIA. My next guest, Joel Whitney, is just out with Flights, Radicals on the Run from Orr Books. It's a look at about 20 American, North, Central, and South, radicals and revolutionaries in their battles with the U.S. security state. Among them, Angela Davis, Lorraine Hansberry, Leonard Pelter, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Rigoberta Menchu, and Manuel Mel Zelaya. His previous book for Orr, Thinks, was about the CIA and the Cultural Cold War of the 1950s, so this latest is the development of some familiar themes. A founder and former editor of Guernica, Joel has written for The Baffler, The New York Times, and Boston Review. Joel Whitney. This is a book of, what, almost 20 essays, but what is the overarching theme behind it? What's the thematic unity here?
I think it's sort of a meditation on borders and sovereignty more than anything else. I mean, obviously, it's following up on some work I did in Finks. And I think even if the reader hasn't read Finks, you'll see that it's a meditation on penetration of cultural and other organizations, political organizations, by the likes of the CIA and the FBI, sometimes illegally congregating around the Americas. And so it's a meditation on protest movements, activism, socially engaged writing and art. And what it's sort of a maybe implicitly kind of a roadmap for how to play defense in addition to the offense that we have to play to get good, humane, non-life-threatening policies.
It seems like a tall order to fight the CIA. So what do you have in mind here?
Knowing your enemy is kind of the pathway that I think unfolds in these stories, and knowing how they penetrate organizations and then ultimately try to control them or split them apart. And so the part in the CIA is very much a follow-up on what was in Finks, which is largely told through the institutional history of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was a CIA cultural front. And basically what the reader needs to know, and will eventually know reading through these essays, is that there was a line you couldn't cross. And a lot of times that line that we couldn't cross is not where we would draw it, especially with the Soviet Union disbanded. But basically this idea of sort of a pro-Western tilt, what they call the non-communist left or NCL, basically the taboos that you couldn't talk about. I think part of what I'm trying to do in looking at these examples of brilliant minds who are on the left, whether authors and playwrights like Lorraine Hansberry or activists like Malcolm X, who is sort of a genius at pointing out and laying out the hypocrisy behind American policy. The process was one of courage for progressives and radicals and leftists and all the labels that they get called to caricaturize their movements for, you know, freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and freedom not to throw our money at violent massacres abroad.
Now, you mentioned the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which plays a prominent role in this book as well. I sometimes wonder if the CIA now is sophisticated enough to pull something like that off. But they were able to open to the left to a certain degree, right? There is a certain canny opening that, as you say, has its limits, but... How effective was that? What was their intention? What were they trying to influence with their efforts?
So the opening was a strategic opening that was very ad hoc in terms of the CIA realizing something reasonable, that they were sort of losing the argument in Latin America after the Bay of Pigs. Certain things before, after, and during the Bay of Pigs had made Latin Americans and the Latin American left in particular suspicious, to say the least. And that suspicion is also instructive to all of us. I mean, I feel like American institutions are failing. Well, this is when it starts, when people see not only how bad the intention is behind some of these acts, which is basically sort of like PR on steroids, you know, making sure that if we do terrible things that the world isn't talking about it. So the opening to the left was not necessarily meant as an open debate or a fair debate, but it was posing as one. And so in order to win over people who are sympathetic to Cuba after the Cuban Revolution, a magazine called Mundo Nuevo was born around 1966. And the irony is that it was born late in the period of CIA magazines and CIA sponsoring culture through the Congress for Cultural Freedom. It came so late that it was close to exposure. I think the rumors were pretty rampant that the Congress for Cultural Freedom had State Department or CIA ties, as we hear in the Garcia Marquez essay. And so that was confirmed about a year and some months after the magazine launched. But the magazine was launched basically to sort of discard, you know, the useless magazines of the CIA that had been created in the 50s and that were following sort of an old script. They were appealing to Latin American intellectuals who called themselves liberals in the Latin American and sometimes European sense, which is kind of a conservative political alignment. And they were trying to reach out to radicals and progressives and the new left, and they were tolerating debates around things like Vietnam, and they even planted a story that was critical of the Vietnam War in order to keep their cover safe when people were starting to spread rumors that it was a CIA front. So it looked like the Cubans and those aligned with the North American sort of anti-communist version of the left were having a debate in the pages of Mundo Nuevo, and to some degree they were, but that was only after some of their operatives had found that after the Bay of Pigs, nothing else would work.
I'm guessing the model was they hoped to influence intellectual discourse, discourse among intellectuals, and then thereby to have some filtration into popular opinion. Journalists pick up on that stuff after high-end people talk about it, right? Is that the idea behind the strategy?
Yeah, I can't remember if it was Francis Stoner Saunders who originally wrote about this or someone else. I think they referred to it as trickle-down culture. And the idea was that if Dwight MacDonald or somebody else was kind of taught through these magazines and writing and editing for them, if they were taught what was kind of no-go, like a tone of dissent that couldn't be too strident against the United States' stated values, pro-democracy sort of rhetoric vis-a-vis the United States and the West. If you could be trained in these magazines, then some of those writers, a lot of those writers like Dwight MacDonald himself, would also be writing for The New Yorker, and you'd be creating kind of a consensus that was a little different from what ultimately became known as the Washington Consensus.
Okay, let's talk about some of the individuals. Lorraine Hansberry achieved some popular success before dying very young, but I guess the mass of Americans don't know much about her politics. Tell us how she fits into this story.
Yeah, I was always curious about her life. And, you know, a lot of these essays are book and film reviews or essay reviews, as they're called sometimes. And Imani Perry's book was instructive, her new newish biography of Lorraine Hansberry called Looking for Lorraine. And also there was a film on Lorraine called Sighted Eyes and Feeling Heart. And I didn't know much about her life either. I knew what most of us know about that wonderful play, that prize-winning play, Raisin in the Sun, of course. But I didn't know that the struggles that she had to go through before and after writing it. I didn't know, for instance, that she was a young protege of both W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson. And I think Robeson sent her to Argentina to sit in on one of these kind of peace congresses that he couldn't go to when his passport was taken. You know, in the 50s, the United States was blocking leftists from going to international congresses and conferences. And there were some moments that should have been embarrassing to the United States, but they didn't really stop doing it. So in that first section, along with Lorraine, you see, I mean, she goes to this congress and she's heralded by the progressives, but the police are surveilling this conference, and so they pretend they're having a prissy ladies' tea, I think is how Perry puts it, and so they act like they're having a prissy tea, and then as soon as the surveillance teams leave, the police leave, they go back to the discussions of sort of left tactics. She comes back, and her parents get a knock at the door. By then, her dad has died, and they confiscate her passport, and so. You know, this is the case with a lot of folks in the first chapter of Flights, whether it's the Oppens, whose passport was taken, George and Mary Oppen, who were poets ultimately in L.A. Hansberry's passport was taken. Robeson's passport was taken. There's a section on him. And so this first chapter is sort of establishing that the rules of citizenship, the rules of your geographical range are one of the first signs of this kind of McCarthyite Cold War repression. But Hansberry went through that at a very young age, and she was an avowed socialist. And as she got older and achieved her success, she was part of this famous meeting with Robert F. Kennedy during the civil rights era, where it was sort of just before Kennedy's own kind of opening, which he made the case to his brother, JFK. After getting it wrong with these activists, and Lorraine is starting to see herself in the late 50s and early 60s as needing to be an amplifier of the voices of working class Black Americans. There's a young activist who's been beaten in the South during the civil rights protests down there, comes to New York for medical treatment on his head and jaw. And he's one of the first to speak up. And because he's young and he's not one of the famous folks there, he was all sort of organized by people like Baldwin, who are better known to RFK. He's shut down this young person, Jerome Smith. Hansberry kind of stepped in and said, no, this is the person who's out there protesting on the streets, who's getting dogs sicked on them, who are on the cover of some of these magazines, but not quite enough yet, and who are becoming the faces of a kind of protest movement that precedes Vietnam, but is very important in establishing how protests work, how the pushback will work, who gets to speak for them, who matters, whose lives matter, and the question around destruction of property and of nonviolence. So she speaks up for him, and Kennedy sort of shakes it off, and the meeting ends because this young person has questioned not only the civil rights stance of the Kennedy administration, but also their proposal to go to Vietnam. It's kind of a pivotal moment in the civil rights fight. I think ultimately there are some folks who talk about how it affected RFK to be kind of shown to be wrong in this meeting. He went and had his brother's year. And there's a lot of scholarship on what the Kennedys did and didn't do. But Hansberry was pushing this. I mean, it was in some ways a bitter lesson. In some ways for the Kennedys, it was actually instructive.
I'm speaking with Joel Whitney, author of Flights, Radicals on the Run, published by Aura Books. Okay, and then Gabriel Garcia Marquez, so you mentioned Mundo Nuevo. He was tricked into writing for them, right? Tell the story of Marquez and Mundo Nuevo.
You can start the story with the letter he wrote when he found out that this magazine that excerpted two chapters of his masterpiece, 100 Years of Solitude, two chapters were excerpted in Mundo Nuevo in, I think, 67, just as this magazine and the cultural front that the CIA created were being outed as CIA instruments. He was pretty mad. And so he wrote a letter to his editor, who was a friend, and said, I won't write for this magazine again. He compared himself to the magazine editor as being sort of cuckolded by the CIA. But he wasn't a total victim. He had heard rumors, and he made that clear. And he said the reason he wrote for them anyway, despite hearing rumors of the CIA's attachment to Mundo Nuevo, was because he thought, maybe naively, he thought that he could, when you write for a magazine, you're influencing it more than it's influencing you. And he thought these would be two excerpts that would be a limited engagement, a limited relationship with that magazine. But once it was exposed, it was timed with the release of his novel in Spanish. And so I think he was a little bit horrified. But I tell the story sort of framed by that moment and sort of the backstory of the composition. I think with García Márquez, you see that some of this repression, some of this error and blunder and coercion by the CIA, I think it was really instructive for some of these writers because they themselves were aware of a strange secret history unfolding around them. And so the title, Flights, obviously it's flights across borders and sometimes the inability to cross borders. And in the third section, of course, it's about immigration, which I hope we get to talk about. But this stifling of the left, this stifling of creativity, this stifling of citizenship, of protest movements, is also sort of a pathway to fixing your mind. It's not ideal. It's not what we would want in a supposedly free society. But García Márquez, I think, you know, he knew he was a socialist. He knew he was not the kind of socialist who was aligned with the USSR. But it was a bitter irony that I think undergirded his already trenchant, satirical, somewhat understated humor. He was not allowed within the United States borders because he was supposed to be a socialist, but he was smuggled into the CIA's magazine's pages.
Since we're talking about 100 years of solitude, I can't resist telling this anecdote. My sister-in-law was a Harvard undergraduate back when Larry Summers was president, and the students had just gotten back from summer vacation. They're all sitting out in the lawn in the nice sunny day, and Larry is walking around talking to the students. And so he sat down with my sister-in-law's group and said, oh, what have you been reading? And one of them says, oh, 100 Years of Solitude. And Larry said, what's that? The president of Harvard University, you know? American Indian Movement, Leonard Peltier, and the less well-known Anam May Akwash. Tell us about the occupation and then this film that was released somewhat later.
Yeah, this film was how I got this window into this story, which became an essay in the Boston Review. But Leonard Peltier was kind of became a name towards the end of and the aftermath of the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973. And all of that culminated into a story of penetration and militarization of tribal lands with a lot of history behind it. But it happened after the Trail of Broken Treaties, which was a march by the American Indian Movement in 72, just before Nixon's reelection. It's probably important to go back even further. I mean, obviously, there were hundreds of years of repression of Indians and Native Americans, and they proudly called themselves the American Indian Movement to reclaim that word. But in the two decades prior to the kind of the formation of this new protest movement, which was certainly kind of in cross currents with Black liberation movements and Black power movements, there had been these policies of defunding reservations. Some of the anti-communists in Congress were saying that Indian reservations were, quote, natural socialist environments. But it was a much older sort of settler colonial policy where they were basically taking tribal members and relocating them to cities across the West, sometimes east of the Mississippi, but I think most of the cities where Native Americans were sent to were big cities in the West. Minneapolis was a big one, and later LA and San Francisco. And they were basically dispersing the reservations. Some of the tribes were completely defunded. Some of them were never sort of reestablished with federal recognition. And this was really impoverishing the reservations. So when the Native Americans looked around and sort of built on seed movements of their activism and sort of sewed them together in this national movement, it resulted in some big occupations. They occupied Alcatraz. They marched across the country in this aforementioned Trail of Broken Treaties, and they established kind of a this version of occupation where they took over the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Indian Affairs. And they actually took the documents, that some of which were their treaties, that showed that they were entitled to lands that they did not possess or were not allowed to live on. And so this concept of occupation that I think informed places like Occupy Wall Street is made famous in this moment. And they were actually occupying the Department of the Interior when Nixon was reelected in the fall of 1972. In the meantime, there was this dispute. There were thugs. There was kind of an operator running the Pine Ridge Reservation, and he was using dirty tricks to...
That was Richard Wilson?
Yeah, that was Richard Wilson. Some people call him Dickie Wilson. And he had some goons. Literally, they called themselves the...
Yeah, there's an acronym GOON, which is really cynical.
Yeah, Guardians of the Oglala Nation. Oglala being one of the bands of Sioux, Lakota people. And so when these protesters were coming back, these occupiers were coming back from the east, from Washington, D.C., there was a dispute going on. And the short version is they ended up sending 50 carloads of folks returning from the Trail of Broken Treaties to Wounded Knee, South Dakota. Jumping back to the film, there was a young cub reporter named Kevin McKiernan, and he quickly made friends with some of the founders of the American Indian Movement, Dennis Banks and Russell Means. And so he got to stay there despite the ban on the free press and the ban on media being there. There was a complete sort of encirclement and a blockade of people getting in. Some people snuck in. And so very quickly it escalates to a situation where hundreds of Native American members of the American Indian Movement are surrounded by federal troops and undercover agents and these goons who... basically all have relationships with the FBI. And illegally, I think it was militarized. I think the National Guard, the Army was also sending in troops undercover. And there were some American Indian Movement members who were shot, but ultimately it de-escalated with negotiations. And the negotiations at first seemed like the government was not acting in good faith, but ultimately, after it de-escalated, I think there were some embittered people who were sort of aligned with the federal government. And so the murder rate just escalates. It was like the country's highest murder rate around Pine Ridge and in that part of the state of South Dakota. Leonard Peltier is part of that movement, and he's hanging out on a ranch a few summers later. And the FBI sort of shows up to do a search looking for weapons or whatever they're purporting to do. And there was a shootout. And Peltier is one of the folks who witnesses it. He's one of the folks who's ultimately named by informants. And he goes on the run and he ends up in Canada. Two others who had gone through this and were tried were released. It was proven to be kind of a witch hunt, just to blame anyone because a couple federal agents died and bled out. So Peltier is convicted based on coerced affidavits, and the whole case against Peltier, which is, you know, has been upheld for more than 50 years, I think, is about as fraudulent a case as you can have. And so Peltier is, I don't want to say rotting in jail. He's writing, he's thinking, he's campaigning, he's networking, but he's also, he's aging, and his family would like him to be released. But there were some FBI agents who were involved who were interviewed by McKiernan, and the ones who were retired somehow convinced themselves to admit some pretty enlightening and illuminating things, which is that, they would be happy, this counterintelligence program the FBI had, would be happy to let people be turned into opponents or enemies. This is how they split movements and sort of goaded into killing each other, is one of the statements. But this method of getting someone to denounce Peltier through false affidavits that might have been coerced at gunpoint, that's stage one. He's convicted. The suppression of the evidence afterwards, Amnesty and other groups were talking about the impropriety of this and essentially equating Peltier with a political prisoner. But in the aftermath of that, first of all, the American Indian Movement is paralyzed because of cases like this and other cases where they tried everyone who was there at Wounded Knee. So for 2 years, many of these activists were either imprisoned or awaiting trial. In the aftermath of that, you have another activist, Anna Mae Aquash, who's being put into what they call the snitch jacket, which is like she's being implicated as being an informant. She's being arrested and released. And it seems like that tactic worked. It seems like someone from the American Indian Movement may have committed the killing against her. Some people still think the government did it. But it's part of this movement to penetrate and pit these activists against each other to sow paranoia and dissent, which is, you know, the roadmap that I think is why some of these stories are instructive to us today if we think about protest movements today.
Yeah, it's like some of the tactics the CIA has used abroad are brought home to this colonized population in the U.S.
Yeah, and as you see at the end, yeah, you see that stuff's happening. The FBI and other groups are doing that, even at domestic protest movements.
And finally, with all this work you've been doing, how does that shade the way you look at the atmosphere, the McCarthyite atmosphere around protest against U.S. support for the war on Gaza?
It's becoming more and more apparent that if you can't change a really disastrously violent and wrong morally and in every other way policy of slaughter, then you're going to be reduced to, you know, controlling the message as best you can. And you do see that, particularly in Guatemala, you see the U.S. supporting an out-and-out genocide there. It was later ruled a genocide under Rios Montt by the UN, and someone who was very much affected by that. I retell her story, Rigoberta Menchú. When the U.S. is aligned with a genocidal state, what it forces those actors, those governments to do is to compartmentalize and to deny what it's doing. And I think it corrupts the ability not only of people involved in a genocide or funding or supporting a genocide, it corrupts their ability to tell the truth. But then ultimately what you're doing is you're building the future distrust in American institutions. You're basically destroying U.S. credibility and respectability in the name of some old Cold War McCarthyite ideal of alliance with somebody who was maybe once useful in the Cold War, but in the name of completely morally inconsistent policies today.
That was Joel Whitney, author of Flights, Radicals on the Run, just out from Orr Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more from the flutist Claire Chase, this Piece in the Shape of a Square by Philip Glass. Till next week, bye.